But I believe it's also a highly fascinating meta picture, to use W.J.T. Mitchell's term, whose problematic yet interesting relation to the historical practice of exhibition making offers fertile ground for analysis in relation to this conference's theme. So I first became interested in Canaletto's canvas when working on the topic of early modern street exhibitions. I use this word street exhibition here for convenience, really. It's an umbrella term that denotes a heterogeneous range of open-air displays of pictures organized on the occasion of joyous entries, processions, celebrations of military victories, saints' days, or as parts of markets and fairs. Such events often led municipalities, parishes, guilds, and other communities to decorate streets and squares with ephemeral architecture and other temporary decorations that could consist of paintings, statues, tapestries, and more, and would also be accompanied by various kinds of performances, for example, of tableau vivant. Now, the literature about ephemeral decorations and about early modern festival culture more broadly is, of course, vast. Yet what receives little attention and what seems to me to be an interesting problem, particularly also in the light of our discussion of the image in relation to materiality, is the use in such festivals of paintings not made for the occasion. So I'm referring to what in German are called Gemälde, in French are called tableau, so paintings often in oil and canvas made on earlier occasions or ultimately destined for other locations that as part of a pageant or another type of festivity are temporarily displayed together in an early modern street, much like Canaletto illustrates it here. In approaching street exhibitions as a somehow discrete element within European festival culture, my paper builds on the seminal work of Francis Haskell and Thomas Crowe. At the same time, my take on the topic also differs from theirs. One of the pioneers, and dare I say this, of the social history of art, Haskell was ultimately interested in early modern displays as precursors to what he calls in his last book from 2000, the Modern Old Master Exhibition. Crowe's approach, and I'm referring here to his book from 1985, is even more strongly teleological. He sees early modern art exhibitions as one of the spaces where modern publics come into being, as they provide location and opportunity for disinterested discussion amongst free citizens. Yet the autonomy of art and its viewing subjects, notions that are underlying these scholars' thinking, only get one so far in making sense of these practices, I believe. While firmly placed in what Hans Belting called the era of art, these temporary displays of images show them inextricably interlinked and often as part of an excessive outpour of sight, sound, flavor, or smell, thereby at least calling into question the individual object's autonomy. While visitors report the overwhelming effects these displays have on them, thus signaling the power of the image that is so central a concern of present-day scholarship in visual studies, Bildwissenschaft, and also art history more broadly, it seems possible that the early modern exhibition made the particularity of the individual painting dissolve. The main concern of my paper, then, is to get a better understanding of the apparently rather unstable status of the painting within the material and symbolic context of the early modern street exhibition. Canaletto's painting, The Feast Day of St. Roch, will thereby not be taken naively, I hope, as an objective record of any such exhibition. I rather want to interrogate it as a meta picture that has something to say about what pictures are and what they do. As Mitchell demonstrates in his essay about this particular type of image, its study is not exclusive to the field of art history. Metapictures can be found in all kinds of visual representations and are in no way confined to the field of high art. Thus, Mitchell takes a different approach from Victor Stoikita, for example, who studied what he called metapeinture within the boundaries of a developing artistic discourse only. Now, this is an important distinction to make, because the idea that Canaletto's painting operates as an utterance about the autonomy of art cannot be taken for granted. Rather, I want to examine the possibility that, like the street exhibitions it references, Canaletto's canvas partakes of the categories of both art and image in a period when such categories were still taking shape. The remainder of this paper is divided in two parts. Part one will examine the materiality of street exhibitions, and with part two, I really look very closely at Canaletto's painting itself. And bringing the two together at the end, I hope to argue that the question of the relation between Canaletti's painting on the one hand and the historical practice of street exhibitions on the other hand can be a question about materiality. So by the time the feast day of Saint Roch was complete, which is generally thought to be around 1735, temporary displays of paintings for public view in the streets were happening in many European cities. Paris played a major role, as Crowe has pointed out. Other cities where this practice developed include Florence, Rome, Antwerp, Amsterdam, London, Prague, and later in the century also in Glasgow, for example. One form such as displays could take was that of the fair. Held on a yearly basis, on and around the feast day of a saint, such fairs dating back to the medieval period offered goods for sale, and in the most opulent form attracted 10,000s and sometimes even 100,000s of visitors who would all be coming to admire the quality and the variety of the merchandise. Paintings displayed at such fairs in cities like Paris, Antwerp, and indeed in Venice could mostly, though interestingly not always, be bought. Another type of temporary display that was widespread, indeed well beyond Europe, happened in conjunction with processions. The most important processions on the liturgical and civic calendars would occasion lavish decorations. Tapestries and other pieces of cloth would be hanging out of the windows of buildings on the route, and temporary architecture marked the event's progression. Such ephemeral constructions appeared in the form of altars, which were decorated with altarpieces, and an example of that is the Corpus Christi procession in Paris. But triumphal arches were also frequently seen and could incorporate paintings as well. Such earlier produced paintings. And an example of that are the triumphal arches built for the Corpus Christi procession in Cusco, Peru, as Carolyn Dean has shown. Thirdly, temporary displays of paintings were being initiated by academies of art, with the first purpose of showing the fruits of their members' work to the wider public. Temporary displays of paintings then were organized for roughly three reasons. At their basis lay commercial, civic, religious, and artistic motives. While the city of Venice could boast a variety of these exhibitions, one of the most famous was the annually recurring display on the square of San Rocco. So here you see another image by another artist, which shows actually only one very large canvas suspended from the facade of the confraternity building of Saint Roch, and you don't see any signs of a procession or so, and this actually illustrates the point that these exhibitions were often ongoing a bit longer than purely the feast day itself. So zooming in on this event, it becomes apparent that it combines the three elements that I just identified. The shows took place annually on and around the 16th of August, when the Venetian Doge, the head of state, and the Senate and the most prominent foreign ambassadors visited the confraternity dedicated to Saint Roch. So this is the confraternity that is called the Scuola di San Rocco, and there they would attend Mass. And after Mass, followed a procession on the church square. And the archives of the confraternity make mention of exhibitions from the year 1678 onwards, when a decree was passed aiming to regulate these in a more streamlined manner. Indeed, there had been a long-standing practice of painters exhibiting their work in the lower hall of the confraternity building, and this was leading, apparently, to chaotic situations. These artists from now on took their work outside, while it was also the case that the Scuola itself added to the exhibition by temporarily bringing works from their own collection into the square. Witnesses to the show attest to a combination of new and older paintings, and it's evident that younger artists used the shows at San Rocco to establish a reputation. Now, as Haskell and Michael Levy argue, for the younger generation especially, the exhibitions were a great commercial opportunity, while more established colleagues were likely to exhibit but not offer their works for sale. As one of the most prolific chroniclers of Venetian artistic life in the 18th century, Pietro Cadenigo attests, the exhibitions of Saint Roch also provided a space for criticism. So on the 16th of August, 1760, he notes in his diary, and I quote, "Following old and praiseworthy tradition, certain young painters have the habit on this day to exhibit to the public on the Piazza di San Rocco their prime works in order to receive the judgment of those who convene there and to profit in the future with improved concepts. And then he goes on to praise the by then 27-year-old Alessandro Longhi for his painting of a Venetian innkeeper who is cutting meat, which according to Gadenigo was very true to life and particularly remarkable for its successful use of 5 different shades of white. Unfortunately, we have no sign of this painting. Probably doesn't exist any longer. Now one wonders whether these commercial and artistic interests ever detracted from the civic religious import of the day or how this went together. Since its earliest days in the later 15th century, the Scuola di San Rocco had been a fervent patron of the arts, and the Brotherhood devoted to Venice's principal plague saint constructed its identity through commissioning architecture, painting, sculpture, and many other forms of art. The exhibitions on the square were in a sense a continuation of these activities, taking the confraternity's artistic splendor from their semi-private building out into the public realm, where it provided an appropriate backdrop to the visit of the head of state. Now, one of the elements in the feast day of St. Roch, Canaletto's painting, that strikes me as a modern spectator is the display of easel paintings against the incredibly rich facade of the scuola, designed in the 1520s by a Venetian architect called Scarpagnino, which surely in itself can count as some kind of image already. Artists of the time certainly also recognized facades as an object of interest, which is shown in this engraving by Michele Marieschi that equally depicts the exhibition of San Rocco and includes an elaborate yet fictive church front. So basically, with comparison to the previous images, we've now turned 90 degrees. And so this is the backdrop of the exhibition in Canaletto's painting, and we're now basically looking towards the church. But my point is that this is completely fictional. This church was just built out of brick and did not have a facade at this time, and now has, but not in any way like this. So this facade really becomes the centerpiece of Majewski's print here. Now, that paintings were actually displayed on intricately decorated backgrounds, such as architectural facades, as Canaletto's and Marieschi's images suggest, that is confirmed by a variety of textual sources as well. In other exhibitions and displays that I'm looking into, easel paintings were shown against tapestries, against frescoes, and are framed by draperies. Now, this abundance of things to look at that this would have led to was not confined to the paintings and their immediate surroundings. So in Canaletto's image, we see brightly colored textiles hanging out of the windows of neighboring houses, like here. There are lavish costumes in which the processing officials are dressed, and the flower garlands that mimic the floral motifs in the architecture and decorate arches of doorways and windows. In other words, contrary to the modern isolation in which paintings often find themselves, here we see this object shown in visually complex surroundings to the extent that the boundaries between the work and its context are unclear. Nor is this effect limited to visuality per se. The flowers are a case in point. Besides the garlands, Canaletto has painted in the hands of each of the members of the cortege a little bouquet. A regular feature of the proceedings at San Rocco that was a reminder of the plague that San Rocco had chased away. A reminder of the plague and its horrific smell. Thus, the painting makes reference not only to the abundant visuality of early modern exhibitions, but also to the way they appeal to the other senses. Here it is the odor of flowers. In other visual written accounts, we find references to festive foods, and in Canaletto's painting, perhaps hinted at by the street vendors' baskets and table with glassware in the right-hand corner. Music and fireworks are other examples of things speaking to the other senses that one finds in street exhibitions. Early modern street exhibitions then presented an abundance of visual cues while also speaking to the visitor's body at large. While a critic like Gadenigo singles out individuals' paintings for praise, he came to these events with a very particular interest, and it's important to allow for the possibility of different types of viewing experience. The way paintings, other decorations, and architectural elements blended in together. An appeal to many of the senses seems to undercut rather than emphasize the autonomy of the single image in these exhibitions. So in the rest of this paper, I want to take a more thorough look yet at Canaletti's colorful and attractive evocation of this exhibition. So, as you can see, Mass has just finished in the moment that Canaletto has depicted here. And the Doge with his entourage, accompanied by the board, the governing board of the confraternity, they are processing out of the church, which you see on the right, clearly with no facade at all. And so they're moving to the left, basically, and this here in gold, under his little umbrella, is the Doge. An awning is protecting the participants from the August sun, while a mass of onlookers witnesses the events. Street vendors have temporarily put down their wares to watch the procession go by. In the background and towering over the event is the splendid confraternity building, to which and to the adjacent buildings on the left are attached a range of easel paintings. A host of figures is actually looking at these paintings, their backs turned towards the dignitaries. Canaletto has painted these images, and I mean the paintings in the painting now, with sufficient precision to suggest that the great variety of Venetian 18th century pictorial styles and genres are all represented here. But none of these individual works have been identified, nor, I would say, were they ever meant to. There are various types of portraits, genre paintings, and a cityscape depicting the Canal Grande, that's this work. So that's much like Canaletto's own type of work. There are also monumental religious paintings, such as this one and this one, possibly alluding to altarpieces that only later would then be installed in churches. But it's very important that I do not think at all that Canaletto has depicted any specific exhibition here. It's rather a more generic evocation of these events. So this precision, or you could also say the deliberate lack of precision with which the paintings within the painting have been depicted, translates to the rest of Canaletto's canvas. He has painstakingly rendered the details of the Scuola di San Luca's facade and the brick exterior of the church. Yet his attention to topographical detail should not be mistaken for the truth. As is well known, Canaletto manipulated the appearance of the city at will to achieve certain compositional effects. In a highly interesting article on 18th century viewing devices and a crisis of single point perspective, Rod Banches has recently argued that Canaletto was one of many artists of its time who experimented with the camera obscura to allow for a more dynamic representation of vision than that achieved by images that follow the rules of Albertian linear perspective, the linear perspective developed in 15th century Florence by Alberti and by Brunelleschi. And I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit technical here now. As Banches writes, and I quote, Brunelleschi, so Alberti's friend, had conceived perspective painting in tandem with a simple cybernetic eye. His viewing device, which bracketed out all of the other senses and reduced vision to a monocular, fixed, mathematical point, was not just a prescription for how to view perspective painting, but also a reductive modeling of how we see the real, unquote. Now, in the feast day of St. Roch, Canaletto can indeed be seen to play with and undermine the Albertian, Brunelleschian single-point perspective. Contrary to what the precision of the rendering of the architecture seems to suggest, there is a range of vanishing points, actually, going horizontally from the edge of the Scuola's main portal, over here, basically, to the very far right of the building, and vertically from the eye level of the closest figures to just underneath the building's entablature. So quite a big variety. The artist has also manipulated the light, which in the painting is coming from the northeast and therefore impossible in reality, thereby allowing the church to throw its shadow on part of the square and its inhabitants. Most importantly, Canaletto has chosen a viewing angle that belies his correction of traditional perspective. The almost panoramic view of the, in reality, rather shallow square, and the way in which overlap between the facades of the Scuola and the church is being avoided imply a viewer who is more dynamic than the ideal viewer of the single point perspective. A viewer whose eyes are moving, or a viewer who is herself on the move. You could also say this differently and say that Canaletto has basically been using wide-angle lenses, or his eye has been doing what wide-angle lenses can also do, moving around and creating a view that with just one viewing point you cannot achieve. So I'm dwelling on Canaletto's depiction of space here because I believe this brings to light an important parallel in this painting between form and subject matter. The artist's dynamic depiction of pictorial space implies a moving viewer, which in turn mimics the movement of the figures in the painting as they process over the square or as they proceed from one exhibited canvas to the next. That is, Canaletto's moving viewer is the participant in a procession, you could say, of a religious or indeed of an artistic kind. Now, as a matter of fact, such a focus on lateral movement is not unprecedented in Venetian painting. 15th century artists, like Vittorio Capraccio, who practiced what Patricia Fortini Brown has coined an eyewitness style, combined an emphasis on lateral movement with a shallow pictorial space and strong horizontals. As you can see in this image here, which provides a really interesting comparison, I think, with the Canaletto. And following an analysis of David Rosand, similar tendencies can be seen to be present in the work of 16th century Venetian Paolo Veronese, for example. More than is the case in Capraccio's painting, however, a depiction of a march of religious figures through a church space. Canaletto's procession is socially articulated. Movement here is a privilege of those who matter most in Venetian society. The ruling class, represented by the Doge and the senators and the confraternity's governing body. Visitors to the exhibition, also in a move, but in a different way, only come second in this scenario. The stillness of the onlooking street vendors, thirdly, marks these people as mere witnesses, as outsiders, a status quo, a sign of their non-participation. The figure of the procession that is so central to content, form, and viewing experience of Canaletto's exhibition painting, as I've argued, is therefore also a marker of social privilege. So I'm coming to my conclusion here. My wider project on early modern street exhibitions is informed by the question how paintings as material objects were handled and experienced in the period that produced them, and informed by the hypothesis that the display of paintings in churches and private palaces is but one part of a much larger story. The temporary display of paintings as part of pageants, fairs, and festivals points to the mobility of these objects and their continuously changing physical surroundings. They're embedding in larger ensembles that were not just visual, but also could be sonorous, olfactory, etc., complicates an understanding of the easel painting as an autonomous work of art in this period. Against this background, I've interpreted Canaletto's Feast Day of St. Roch as a meta picture that reflects on the visual environment of 18th century Venice. While frustratingly little is known about the work's early history, approaching it merely as a disembodied image would mean missing important elements of its meaning. The work stands as an evocation of an event with religious, commercial, and aesthetic dimensions. Yet it does more than that. Canaletto's rendering of the widely known exhibition at San Rocco positions the viewer of his painting as somehow a participant in the proceedings. Our eyes, or even our bodies, move along the canvas, mirroring the way the Venetians process along theirs. Thus, the work compels us not to stand still. In the light of later developments, the invention of a modern viewing scenario in which high art was to be experienced in motionless immersion, Canaletto's exhibition painting stands out. Thank you.